Hey, thanks so much for listening to this message. My name is Jason, and I'm one of the ministers here at the Madison Church of Christ. It's our hope and prayer that the teaching you hear today will bless your life and draw you closer to God. If you're ever in the Madison area, we'd love for you to stop by and study the Bible with us on Sundays at 5 p.m. or Wednesdays at 7 p.m. If you have questions about the Bible or want to know more about the Madison Church, you can find us online at madisonchurch.org. Be sure to subscribe to this podcast, as well as our sermons podcast, Madison Church of Christ Sermons. Thanks again for stopping by. I hope this study is a blessing to you.
This quarter, we're going through the book, The Men We Need, and I mentioned to Pete, he asked me, when he came up and asked me if I'd be willing to do a couple of classes, that I was actually really glad that we'd be going over this, because it's just something that's been on my mind a lot lately is, you know, in our society today, the role of like masculinity in men seems to be under attack. But so I thought this would be a good study for all of us, and something I've been looking forward to. But I know in the world today, like in the Lord's church, those of us who read the Bible, understand it, the roles for men and women are laid out and they're pretty clear. But in society at large, when it comes to masculinity, what it means to be a man or a woman, sometimes it's a little bit less distinct. So I'm really glad we have this chance to go through this this study together. So there's a lot of verses in the Bible that they're commands, and it looks like it's given to men, but it actually kind of applies to both men and women. It's a general command. And if we don't mind, we'll go over and read a few of these. Can I get somebody to read 1 Corinthians chapter 14, verse 20?
Brethren, do not be children in understanding. However, in malice, be babes. But in understanding, be mature.
Thank you. Can we get somebody to read Proverbs 25:28 and Micah 6:8? And I know this one is a kind of favorite of mine. I, a long time back, got my grandmother a picture with this verse on it. Had it up on a wall, and when she passed away, I took it home. We got it now at our house. But if somebody wouldn't mind reading that.
He has shown you, O mortal, what is good. And what does the Lord require of you? To act justly and to love mercy and to walk humbly with your God.
So we can see here in these verses, the verses are addressed to men, but we can see that it's something that applies across to men and women, anybody who's following the Lord. So that takes us, though, to some that are specific to men. We can see from these verses that God does have an ideal. He does have something in mind when he talks to us about being men and to act like men. So if I can, would somebody mind reading 1 Corinthians 16:13? If somebody wouldn't mind, Job 38:3 and Job 40:7. Those are both kind of the same verses, but if y'all wouldn't mind reading that.
Now brace yourself like a man. I will question you and you shall inform me. Now brace yourself like a man. I will question you and you shall inform me.
I know when I read that verse, I know sometimes it's like God is not really happy with Job and the way that he's been represented. But to me, that was always kind of encouraging. It's like this idea that God has this expectation of us. He's given us this dignity that we're supposed to act like men. To me, that was always something in that verse that sort of made me feel that we have something to stand up for, that there's this role that we're supposed to be. Can I get somebody to read 1 Kings 2:1-2?
When David's time to die drew near, he commanded Solomon his son, saying, I'm about to go the way of all the earth. Be strong and show yourself a man.
All right. And finally, Proverbs 27:17. The first three verses, we can see that these verses are specifically addressed to men or expecting people to act like men, and it is something distinct from being a woman or to Christians in general. The last one actually technically should go on the verse before, but I kind of had it in mind for this class. It's probably pretty appropriate. I know a lot of you in here know a lot more than I do, a lot wiser, a lot smarter, and we all probably have different perspectives. So, you know, in this class, maybe we can have a discussion. If you got any comments, please feel free to speak up. And if there's any pushback on anything you hear me say, by all means, let me know. But I just thought it would be appropriate here, since hopefully we can use each other to sharpen each other and move forward. So the next slide I've got here, it's a video I found a little while back, and it just kind of hit me as peculiar. The two ladies you see there, and it doesn't look like the video is going to play. Well, I'll give the background and we'll cross our fingers. But the two ladies in this video, the one on the right is Vice Admiral, I've been sick this past week, so I'm still kind of, my voice is kind of getting over and my lips are dry. So Vice Admiral Linda Fagan. At the time this video was made, she was the Vice Commandant of the Coast Guard. I think later she became the Commandant of the Coast Guard. But the video here, it's her and one of her officers, and they're kind of going over older manuals, codes of conduct for the Coast Guard, and they're kind of comparing them to how things are today. But just something they said in this video kind of caught my attention. I just thought I'd share it and see what you guys saw, if you have any comments. But
they were going to just undervalue you.
Attitude toward women. Nothing so quickly discloses the presence or absence of breeding in a man as thus his attitude towards women. I can't even finish the rest of this. The true gentleman adheres to the view that women deserve a special consideration and protection. It is his constant aim to shield them from unpleasant or embarrassing situations, to assist them when confronted with danger or hardship, and on all occasions to so conduct himself as to contribute most to their pleasure and happiness. For men to make women feel protected, you know.
I hope I make you feel protected when I do. You know, thanks man, I'm glad to do it. I feel the same for you. I feel protected, I feel safe, okay, but you know we shouldn't have a third gender role on it to feel safe or you know respected, just respect should be given. All right, I'm not tech savvy enough to know how to just put the clip in there without cutting off the end, so it started where I needed it to. Does anybody have anything that stood out to them or any comments on the video, anything in particular that jumped out? I know to me, the thing that hit me was when I was watching it, first off, it seemed like they didn't quite understand the context that the word breeding was used in there. It looked like that threw them for a loop. But it also seemed that they were sort of poking fun at this idea of gentlemen, this idea they had of being polite, looking out for women, protecting them. It was as if that was something that was kind of foreign to us today. And I do think the idea of protection, if you look back at most of history, and actually most of the world today, women are pretty much at the mercy of the men that they're around. They really don't have any recourse in a lot of places and a lot of times in history. But as our world became more civilized, in civil society, there weren't as many dangers, I think, to women. And it was because of attitudes like, you know, we just saw people looking out for them, taking care of them, to the point where apparently these like two don't really have to worry about too much when it comes to protection. But I guess as an example, I just want to say, like, there's a lot of things that I really admire about my wife. She's absolutely smarter than me.
Amen.
Yes. I'm an engineer. She's a kindergarten teacher. And there's plenty of times I'll be at my house trying to jerry-rig something or work out some problem, and I'm working at it for a while, can't figure it out, don't know what's going on. I mean, she'll walk by, look at it for a second, like, well, why don't you try? And it's like absolutely the most obvious, easiest like solution. It's Ottman's razor, goes straight to the point, and it works. It never crossed my mind. She's really smart. We have the stereotype of men are usually calm, rational, collected, and women get emotional and hysterical. With us, it's kind of the reverse. She keeps her head in situations. She handles pressure easily. She knows she doesn't overreact, whereas me, I kind of don't really process the situation, just kind of jump through and either get angry, upset, you know, kind of fly off the handle. But she handles pressure and stuff that things like that a lot better than I do. I tend towards emotional responses. I have 100% confidence in her ability to handle situations and her wisdom, judgment, discretion, and I trust her with anything. That being said, you know, if we're walking down the street or the proverbial dark alley, and, you know, there's a couple of suspicious-looking guys at the end of the alley, the first thing I think isn't, you know, well, it's all right, I got Katie beside me, you know, we can handle this. You know, it's... I'm even more nervous or tense in the situation because my first thought is, you know, she could get hurt. I have to protect her. As much as I love and respect my wife, I'd feel much better walking down that alley with anybody in this room, you know, than her. So that was just kind of the first thing that came to my mind. It sort of bothered me a little bit that they would be, poking fun at this idea of chivalry and that men will actually be respectful. Good men would be willing to stand there and look out for them. So to go back to Admiral Fagan and even the people in our sphere, other ladies that interact with us in a day, or as the book talks about, people who are in kind of our proverbial garden, people in that garden who are vulnerable, even if they don't think they need our protection, if they need somebody there to look out for them, the fact that we are there, we have the ability to do it, it's what God designed us for, and that's what he expects, even if these people don't necessarily acknowledge it or are even looking for it. So the first section, the first section of the chapter in the book, Protect the Vulnerable, it talks about your neighborhood should be safer simply because you're there. And, you know, here's a quote. He says, you know, if the men show up, the most vulnerable aren't going to be so vulnerable anymore. And if you read the book, there's a part where he talks about this man, Dishel Soku, I think that's how you pronounce his name. He's from Florida, and at first I thought, oh, Florida, but it turns out it's Florida's a region in South Africa. But, it is. I didn't know that. Him and his father were working, you know, at a restaurant that they own, and because his father was vigilant, he, you know, talked to Dishel because they saw a man that looked suspicious. And because they were aware of their surroundings, they were aware of, you know, dangers that people posed, they saw him, kept their eye on him. So I'm going to play the video. And what I want you to keep in mind, the guy's trying to take this little girl, you know, he's going to come in on the fence over here. But you can see as soon as he comes on the screen, you'll see Disha walking up. And I decided to put this video in because Brant mentioned it in his book, so I was curious, and I thought maybe if you hadn't seen it yet, it might be something that interests you. But
at a time when the country is gradually transitioning back to normal, the public is reminded to remain vigilant. A recent video making the rounds on social media horrifically depicts this. The video begins with two women and a child seated at a pizza parlor. Seconds later, the suspect is seen storming into the restaurant and grabbing the child. The owner, who acted swiftly, anonymously detailed the encounter.
We were sitting outside and there were other customers here. There was a lady with her two kids. And I noticed that there was a guy running in the shop. From outside, he ran into the shopping center. And when I saw him coming towards us is when my guard went up. So as soon as I saw him come towards the restaurant and jump over is when I stood up and intervened. At the time, my only thought was I need to save this child. And the only way to do that was to restrain him in such a way that he would let go of the child. The child was traumatized. She was actually hysterical and she couldn't control herself. And she was about 6 years old probably. But yeah, she was really hysterical. And they were here for quite some time before she calmed down and they could leave.
The 24-year-old son.
So we see there that the reason that he was able to react and protect someone who needed his protection, he was capable of protecting, was a simple fact that he was aware of the dangers that were in the garden, that were in his environment. And that's kind of one of the things that Brant talks about in the book that we need to be aware of. And not all the time, as a matter of fact, I'd say 99% of the time, the action that we need to take for someone isn't physical confrontation. 9 times out of 10, the action that we need to take might be to speak encouraging words, to talk to somebody, help somebody out, but we need to be aware of those needs in the environment that's around us. So moving on, and there may be some here who disagree with me, and if so, let me know, but I do believe that the Bible authorizes us to use whatever means we have at our disposal, physical, financial, spiritual, to handle a situation up to using physical force. And so we got some verses here that I'd like to go through just because of what some of the class talks about. I just wanted to go ahead and at least mention this and make sure, or see if anybody had any disagreements, but make sure that at least we addressed it. Wanted to make sure we include at least a New Testament reference, seeing how the first couple were Old Testament, but I believe that they illustrate principles that God holds and expects of us. But Luke 13:3, and I'm open for comments, but here to me it's always been, because there was a time I thought I had a good grasp on my stance on the use of physical force and Christians. I was reading a book a few years back about another religious group, and I was shocked at how close the things that they believed in mirrored us, to the point where, I mean, it seemed like we would pretty much the same, or at least in a lot of ways. The one thing that hit me was they had a completely different view than I did on the use of force as a Christian. They believed that at no time should we ever engage. They believed in complete passivity, even to the point that the government shouldn't even execute the death penalty. So that, because they were so closely aligned with a lot of other things that we believed, I was like, well, maybe I misunderstood. So I went back and looked just to make sure that I was really like solid in my position there. So I'd gone back and looked. I still have that same opinion that we are authorized to defend ourselves and those around us. But I'd like to open it up if anybody's got any comments, anything that they want to add, talk about. All right, so I think we're all in agreement, or at least those that aren't shy. So moving on, it's kind of a funny portion of the book. The next section he talked about was Mouse Utopia. Had any of y'all heard of this before or read this? Okay. So the young guys that were still in school seemed to hit that. But I had not heard of this experiment before. But so he talks about this experiment by a man named John B. Calhoun that did back in the 60s to study the overpopulation of mice, or using mice. And mice were given this environment where they had plenty of space, plenty of food, plenty of water. The bedding was constantly changed, so it was an ideal environment. It looks kind of scary there. It doesn't really look like a mouse utopia to me, but maybe that's just the graininess of the film. And in black and white, it actually looks like something out of Orwell, but we'll go on. So you can see a graph here. Bottom is number of days the experiment went. There's the population that the mice went to. So it started out, there were 4 pairs of mice that were introduced into the environment. And so at first, the mice did really well, and their numbers doubled like every 55 days. But after day 600, with enough space to accommodate up to like 1,600 more mice, the population peaked at about 2,200. And then they began to just really decline, straight down to the point of extinction of the entire colony. in spite of all their material needs being met, and there was absolutely no effort required on the part of any mouse to meet their needs. Everything was taken care of. Calhoun noted that like the turning point in this experiment occurred at about day 315, when the first signs appeared of a breakdown of the social norms and structure. He said that aberrations included females abandoning their young, males no longer defending their territory, both sexes becoming more violent, more aggressive, deviant behavior, sexual and social, mounted with each passing day. And he even said that the last 1,000 mice tended to avoid any stressful activity and actually any contact. They would go off by themselves, completely isolate themselves, and they would just sit there grooming themselves, eating, drinking, but avoided any kind of contact with the other mice, had no interest in anything but taking care of their own needs alone. Said that they actually, to look at them, looked like ideal specimens of what these mice were supposed to be. They looked perfect, but when exposed to any kind of stimulation, they basically freaked out. That they were, mice aren't known for their intelligence, but these were particularly stupid. That quote there at the bottom, hopefully you can see it, looks to be a little bit smaller than what I thought it might be up here. But it's Calhoun. He did the experiment on mice, but he had thought about the parallels with human society the whole time. And he says, herein is the paradox of a life without work or conflict. When all sense of necessity is stripped from the life of an individual, life ceases to have purpose. The individual's, and that should be dies in spirit, but I can't type. So it just looks like these mice, when they were robbed of any purpose, they were, the chance to be what God designed them to be was taken away, and they didn't have to struggle. They didn't have to meet the needs the way that God had designed them to do, basically just went crazy. And does anybody have any comments? Because I think we can see there's a lot of parallels on society today.
Yeah, there's a lot of, it seems like there's a lot of parallels to society today. How many people have hundreds, if not thousands, of followers or friends online, but have no personal connections in real life?
Yeah. Yeah. Anybody else?
So it makes me think of how blessed we are today in society. There's so much that's like, I think a lot of us take for granted. I mean, you go to the grocery store, you buy your food, and yeah, you have to like work to like get the money to do those things, and we get some purpose in that. But I just think we live in a society where like things are physically way easier than they've ever been, and yet at this moment in time, we find ourselves more depressed than ever, more anxious than ever, mental diseases just running rampant. And when you like brought up just the side effects the mice were seeing when life was like hunky-dory and easy, I couldn't help but think about, you know, a lot of the things that we struggle with today. It's almost like, I mean, one of my personal theories, I guess, is that you have time to think about those things, and you have like time to, I guess, philosophize about how you wish things were, and with that comes like almost a sense of depression, anxiety. But I think this is another explanation, which is just that you lose purpose, you lose drive, and that takes away like an aspect of, mice don't have humanity, but you know,
right,
just I guess part of existence, I don't know.
Yeah, no, I appreciate that. That's like really good comment.
Yeah, this reminds me of the study Mr. Berry was talking about in a class he taught last quarter, where it was the number one reason young people are leaving the church is not being challenged enough. And this seems like a pretty good parallel to that.
Yeah, I think those are all like really great points. And I know I was talking to my wife when I was getting ready for this lesson, and you know, it was kind of along the same lines. It seems like as a society, and it seems like for generations, really, each generation, the struggle seems to be less. I mean, we all work hard, but not really compared to people 150 years ago. That was a different kind of hard work. You know, it seems like we have a lot more leisure time, and that leisure time, that lack of struggle, and outside of the church, I mean, lack of purpose, truly. I mean, and I think maybe some people in the church might struggle with that too, but at least in the church, we do understand we do have a reason for being, and we do have something greater than ourselves to serve, which, you know, may also be one of the reasons, if you look at the studies, that people in churches tend to be happier and more content with their lives. But yeah, I don't know. That's kind of what I was thinking. And these two men wrote an article on the that experiment. And this is one of what they said. You know, the last line really hit me. It's like they self-isolated, overindulged, and turned to violence. And yeah, that sounds a lot like a lot of boys and men in our society today, particularly. It's like that seems to be a trend. Does anybody else have any comments?
I was just going to say real quick, you know, one of the things, if you look at throughout history, we're not the first culture to be this way, but it is more rare than not how we are, which is avoiding all of that negativity. So anything that's hard or stressful or anxiety-ridden, the idea is avoid all of that and then just do good. Mm-hmm. If you look at other cultures, specifically like East Asian cultures, I mean, let's embrace it. We're going to use that to grow. We see a lot of that in Romans with Paul talking about how the suffering of the present age will bring forth glory and things like that. And I think that's something too, because I don't know, at least especially for my generation and me specifically, like most of my life and probably until I reached my early 20s, it was like anything bad, I'm going to try to avoid that. Anything that makes me uncomfortable, scared, anxious, whatever, I'm just going to not do that and run away from it and just do things that make me feel good.
Yeah.
And a lot of times that's not the overall best thing for us as humans.
Yeah, speaking of, like, you know, the East, it's proverb, you know, I think it's Chinese proverb on that. It's like, if you reject iron, you won't make steel. You know, that same idea. Yeah, anybody else?
Yeah, when, you know, it's kind of like our generation that's messed up some when we said we don't want our children, we don't have it easier than we had. I had it pretty good. Well, my family, we did. We weren't farmers. We worked and lived in the city, and we had it pretty good. And I wanted my boys to have more than I did, but to get something, you got to do something. Mm-hmm. And that's the way we looked at it.
Yes, sir.
If you want something, you got to do something.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, my dad. I was using that illustration, and I think it was at the hospital over here is doing a lesson, but it was one of the same illustrations. My dad, when I was younger, he's like, yeah, if you save up this much money, I'll get you a go-kart. And I had absolutely no doubt in my mind that if I had done that, he would have gotten it for me. But when I got about 3/4 of the way there, I decided I wanted to spend my money on something else, so I didn't get my go-kart. But I knew for a fact, had I done it, he would have kept his word. But yeah, if you wanted something, I had to do something for it. Let's see. Oh, hey, yeah.
you might be going here in a minute, but at the end of 1 Thessalonians, just what we're talking about together made me think about it. 5:14, and we urge you, brothers, admonish the idle, encourage the faint-hearted, help the weak, be patient with them all. It's like, I'm sorry if I...
No, I was going to say, that's actually a great point, and I was not going there. I'm glad you brought that up. That was not something, and that is, yeah, it's that's a great point. So what we do actually matters, and sometimes it might be hard to buy into that. I know God's designed us with responsibilities as men, and he's also given us talents and things that he expects of us as individuals. I mean, he's had plans for each one of us. And, you know, sometimes it's hard to really wrap your head around the fact that God does truly have something he designed me for. But if that's true, then we also understand that what we do actually does matter in the long run to multiple people. many times that when we think of somebody in need, and Brant says something about this that really hit me because it hit home. When it comes to something that I'm struggling with, I find I have no problem putting in my part. As a matter of fact, more often I'll do more relying on me than I do on God. But when it comes to a situation where somebody else may be in need, you know, there's times where, you know, it said that, okay, well, if God really wanted that to get taken care of, you know, he'll find a way to get it. And I kind of absolve myself of responsibility for it. So I end up relying more on God than I should, because he expects us to be active. And it reminds me, it's an example of what you do matters, and it also kind of helps to make the point of God expects us to be his instruments. But back at my home congregation, when I first got in the Army, I was a new Christian, and I wanted to make sure I stayed a Christian. I was looking around at a lot of the older men in the congregation who'd been faithful for years, so I had the idea, hey, if I do what they did, I'll be what they are. And so I figured I'd hang out with these older guys, talk to them, and kind of learn. But one of them, for years, it was a couple of years, every Tuesday night, sometimes an hour, sometimes longer, he would have me in his home. We'd sit there and study things in the Bible, or he would just, you know, let me talk about things that, questions I had about spiritual things. We'd go over a lot. It was huge for me as a new Christian, helping me solidify myself in the faith. It really helped give me that foundation. And what he did really, truly had an impact on my life going forward. It really strengthened me. Whereas had he not done that, as much as I struggle now, it might have been a whole lot worse. But one of the things he said during that, and this is kind of what gets back to the original point, is he kind of noted that when we look in the Bible, once the church was instituted, nobody except men told other men how to be saved. Even when Jesus appeared to Paul or Saul on the Damascus Road, he didn't tell Saul what to do to be saved. He told him where to go, and he had a man tell him what he had to do to be saved. So this side of the cross, God has a will, he has a plan, but that plan is for us to teach others. Yes, like the Holy Spirit's guided people, like Philip and the Ethiopian eunuch, to them, but he expects us to do our part. We have to be willing to step up, because if we don't do it, somebody is going to miss their chance at heaven. And it reminds me, Brandon, a couple of weeks back, the story you told in South Carolina, the mission trip that y'all went on. I was thinking about that when we were doing this, is that elder. And in my mind, when you were telling it, I had it on a Sunday afternoon. Whether it was or wasn't, that's the way I pictured it. You know, after church on a Sunday afternoon when y'all went to visit the lady in the hospital. But the way I saw it was that elder in the church, when they went to visit the lady in the hospital, youth group sang, prayed with her, and they talked, and they were getting ready to go, but the elder, you know, just started talking to the lady specifically about her need for Jesus. It wasn't like, hey, we're going to be praying for you. He knew that she was dying. He knew that she wasn't a Christian, and that man easily could have, when, you know, everyone was finished, be thinking like lunch, or you know how it is between Sunday morning service and Sunday night, there's a lot of things you've got to get done in order to get back to church in time. He easily could have made an excuse like, she's hurt a lot of times, you know, she'll make up her mind when she makes up her mind, you know, we've done all we could. But he asked her specific questions, and he didn't just let it go. And it made an eternal impact, because if I'm not mistaken, shortly thereafter she became a Christian, and very soon after that she passed away. And just a few minutes, hour that he took on a Sunday afternoon had an eternal impact, not just on her, but on God as well, because it kind of reminds me of sermon that Caleb Williams, you know, little, when he was like really little, gave, where he was talking about he got lost in the mall. And his mom, Chrissy, was like, when they finally found him, came up and she was crying and he was wondering, well, why is she so upset? I mean, yeah, I was lost, but she's got, you know, she's got other kids. And he was using that like to illustrate how God hits us. And I mean, it's the funniest thing, but for me, I always knew, yes, God loves me and he loves me as an individual. It never sunk in the way it did when he said that, oh, that's how God actually responds to us. So because of the few minutes that man took, he brought someone that precious to God. He was God's hands and was able to bring her home. So the things that we do matter. I'm going to open, like, does anybody have any examples of people you know or times yourself where you acted or...
I'm going to say, you're talking especially about men being present and protection and those kinds of things. You know, years and years ago, my kids were very small, but there became an opportunity after some school shootings that this man created an organization called Watch Dogs. And the whole point of Watch Dogs was to provide protection at our schools, because they found that if men are present on the campus, criminals will move on to the next place. That just that presence of a male figure, a male sense of authority, that makes all the difference psychologically to people, even who have ill intentions. It's kind of like that video you showed, two women with a child were easy pickings according to that guy. But had a man been there, it would have been a lot less likely that that would have happened. But what's happened too often is we as men, and this has happened over years and years and years, right? But we've gone to work, and it's no longer that we take our kid with us to teach them a trade. It's we go to the office, we go to the factory, we go off to work, and we leave children at home with mothers. And so that connection that we should be making with our children as we teach them all these little things, not just a trade, but how God works in our lives while we're teaching them that trade. This has all happened over many, many years. But little by little, what's happened is we've detached further from the home. Wives are bitter with us because we're not present. You have a women's liberation movement that discounts manhood. And over time, we get to this spot where the genders are trying to be blended all into one big thing because we don't actually demonstrate for them what true masculinity and protection and care and watch over them. We don't do that with them. So you have women looking for something else besides us. And it is time for us to step up.
Yeah. No, I absolutely agree. Does anybody have anything they want to share? Like any times you saw somebody step up or fail to? Well, no, we've only got a few minutes, so I'll try to get this in quick. But since I picked on Andrew, or Brandon, I also hit Andrew. One of the things that kind of hit me as I was going through the study and was thinking about was as we look out for people that are, you know, are in our garden and try to bring order to that chaos, the relationships that we develop with them aren't just between us, but it also affects other people that are in our sphere. I mean, it's just natural that, you know, you feel a kinship with somebody who's very important to a person that you respect, you know. And an example is, you know, Andrew's dad back at university. When I, again, the same church that I was talking about before, Dennis Edson was super nice guy. When I first came, he was very diligent about me being a new guy in town, new person at the church, as I'd just gotten out of the Army and just come back to Montgomery. But he was always trying to make sure I was a new student at Faulkner, that I wasn't left out, that I never felt isolated or alone. And I didn't particularly, but he was wanting to make sure that I always felt included, that, you know, I was always part of it. And he was just super nice guy. He was the kind of person that would always ask, the conversation you would have him was always about you. You know, he didn't care anything about himself. But Andrew, as a kid, was really respectful, very nice, and it was almost if it had been anybody else's son that would act like that, you'd almost think, man, it can't be real. This guy's got to be somebody else when adults aren't around. But knowing who his parents were, you know, it made it easy to accept. No, face value, this is who he is, knowing the family that he came from. So anyway, I appreciate it, and we will continue on next week. Thank you all.